Case 94 from the Book of Equanimity. Dong Shan was unwell. A monk asks, "Your reverence is unwell. Is there someone, after all, who is not sick?" Dong Shan said, "There is." The monk asked, "Does the unsick person nurse your reverence?" Dong Shan said, "The old monk is properly nursing that one." The monk asked, "How about when your reverence nurses him?" Dong Shan said, "Then the old monk does not see that there is illness." And case 83 from the Book of Equanimity. Guishan asked Dao Wu, "Where have you come from?" Dao Wu said, "I come from nursing the sick." Guishan said, "How many people are sick?" Dao Wu said, "There are some sick and some not sick." Guishan said, "Isn't the non-sick one yourself?" Dao Wu said, "Sick and not sick have no connection with that matter. Say quickly, say quickly." Guishan said, "Even if I could reply, it would have no connection with that matter." And one more quote before I launch off into unknown territory from the Jewel Mirror Samadhi by Dong Shan. "Move and you are trapped. Miss and you fall into doubt and vacillation. Turning away and touching are both wrong, for it is like massive fire." Some years ago, I had the privilege of doing a workshop, a day-long workshop, with a Vipassana teacher named Joanna Macy. David came with me, and later on, David actually served as her assistant for at least one other, maybe more, workshops like this, but I only went to the one. The name of the workshop was "Despair and Empowerment in the Nuclear Age." This was a long time ago. This was at the time that the primary concern for many people on the left was a nuclear war, nuclear power, and the dangers of nuclear power. And one of the practices we did was a guided contemplation where we were asked to imagine, and I thought this was a really lovely invitation into a realm we don't talk about much here in Boundless Way Zen, but which is part of traditional Buddhism, to imagine that we were all in the Tushita heaven. That's the heaven where we abide before being born into this stinking skin bag. And to imagine that we were up there, and in the Tushita heaven, there's no time and there's no space. There's no past or future. This talk of past lives and future lives is a bit of a misunderstanding of a realm of complete timelessness and spacelessness from which comes forth everything. And in the Tushita heaven, we were all there looking at the planet and having decided we were going to be born on the earth, looking for a good time and a good place to be born so that we could do something to help heal the broken world. And in this long guided contemplation, we went into great detail. But I considered what it was about my birth, the time and the place and the parents that I was born to, and having an older brother and being born in Boston, what that might say about what was mine to do for this world that's on fire, as the Buddha said. What was mine to do? And I was born in the 1950s in Boston to a very extremely leftist set of parents who spent all the time that I knew them fighting against things. They fought against the McCarthyism of the 1950s. and they fought against racism, and they fought against the war in Vietnam, and they fought against the threat of nuclear holocaust. And they were very devoted to these fights, and it was very inspiring to me. Unfortunately, my older brother was not quite as inspired, and maybe just to bring some balance to the family, he volunteered to go to Vietnam and fight there. After he came back, my father died shortly after that. It was not a happy time for me. As a young child in the 50s, I had been taught that nuclear war was imminent and taught to hide under our desks at certain points. Somehow that practice faded away. I felt some relief because I didn't know what hiding under a desk was going to do. I had read the New Yorker article by John Hersey about later, not too many years later, because I loved to read even as a little tiny kid, and about Hiroshima, and it didn't look like hiding under a desk had much effect. But I did it because I was a good girl, and my teachers told me to. And I remember the fear of this unknown thing descending upon us so vividly. It had a very big impact on me because my parents took it very seriously too. That's why they marched and organized and tried to vote in candidates who were against nuclear proliferation. It was inspiring, but for a little girl it was also very scary. Things happened later that were much more scary in what I like to call the world of reality. But I'm talking right now about the world of a fearful imagination. And when Joanna Macy asked, why were you born when you were born? I realized that I was born shortly after World War II, when certain things had turned upside down in the way that we think of civilization. When some of us were at the Western Dharma Teachers meeting, and we heard about this on the first day of Sesshin, so many years ago now, from Josh, so eloquently about these presentations that touched us so much. For me, it was a callback to those days. And one of the things that gentleman, whose name I can't remember right now, but maybe during the Dharma Dialogue, Josh will be kind enough, or someone will be kind enough to remind me, said was that in 35 to 50 years, it's not that the world is going to end, but civilization as we know it was going to end. And somehow in the 1940s and 50s, this was very present in the imaginations of many people, I think, not just me. The revelation of the concentration camps was a shock to people. The bombs dropping on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was a shock to people. When the news came out about Dresden and the bombing of Dresden, that was a little bit of a minor shock, but still a shock to people, that civilization as we know it could produce such devastation, such ignoring of the human compact to care for each other. So I didn't have the grown-up brain to process this, and I was scared. And I found refuge not in the Dharma, that came later, but in science fiction. And I still find refuge in science fiction. I read books about holocausts and the end of civilization as we know it. I mentioned to one of you when you asked me yesterday, what are you going to talk about tomorrow? I said, I think I'm going to talk about the zombie apocalypse. And here I am talking about the zombie apocalypse. Not a big fan of zombie stories, but the current culture is full of them. I made a list of all the science fiction stories that I knew about and all the different ways that the world, the civilization as we know it, was going to end in the incredibly creative imaginations of human beings. And it was a really long list. It takes half a sheet of paper, and I'm sure it's incomplete because it's only the TV shows and the movies and the books that I've been exposed to. I bet we could come up with a longer list. The human imagination is so profoundly amazing, just like the Dharma, of which it is a part. And I'm not going to go in that direction right now. But the very first movie I ever saw in a theater, I can't believe my parents took me to see this movie, but it was about the end of civilization as we know it. I found out later that the causal condition for this particular apocalypse, which was part of this movie called The Time Machine, was not nuclear holocaust, and it wasn't plague, and it wasn't zombies, and it wasn't vampires, and it wasn't all the other things that we imagine are happening now when we avoid looking at what is happening now. It was actually class warfare that brought about the end of civilization as we knew it. And the bad guys in this scenario, which was written by H.G. Wells, who was a leftist himself and was writing it as a kind of prediction after World War I. So that was the end of civilization as some people knew it. The bad guys were afraid of light. And from that time on, I asked my mother to get me a nightlight to keep the Morlocks away. Turned out the Morlocks were the proletariat. And the Eloi, the other group, I can't believe I remember these things, were the effete upper classes. They seemed to be the good guys, but they were actually a prediction by H.G. Wells of a certain kind of way that human beings stop interacting with the world, get stuck in a kind of helplessness. They were completely helpless. They were actually cattle for the Morlocks to eat, because that was all that was left in that world thousands and thousands of years in the future to eat. This capacity to imagine disaster is built into our DNA and is really an important part of our survival mechanism. But it causes us quite a lot of pain. I love these scenarios. I still watch them. One of the other ways that civilization as we know it ends, and one of my favorite ways now, because there are a lot more of these stories coming out, is not that we devastate the planet through our turning away from our greed, anger, and ignorance. It's not through nuclear war, but it's because aliens invade and take over the planet. That's sort of comforting in a way. Not my fault. It's those damn pesky aliens. God, they're so annoying, aren't they? And dangerous. It's that damn pesky virus that's turned us into zombies. It's not my fault. I'm just doing the best I can here, keeping all my stuff in my room, piling it up, protecting it, putting my arms around it, closing my eyes. This is what we do to protect ourselves. Not my fault, not my responsibility. But what is our responsibility? Dongshan says turning away and touching are both wrong, because it is like a massive fire. He's not talking about just the state of the world. The zombie apocalypse was probably not a big part of Dongshan's mind and experience, but it didn't need to be the zombie apocalypse, because it's been this way for as long as we know recorded history takes us. War and pestilence, oppression, these things we chant about have been with human beings forever. Also built into our DNA to be in conflict and to deal with conflict by fighting or turning away, or as one of my favorite James Hillman books goes, the title of his book, where he decided to take war as a psychoanalytic patient. He calls his book The Terrible Love of War, some of us just love the conflict. We fall in love with it. As Hungjir says, we become its partner. But we're suggesting another practice here. In our practice, we don't fall in love with these things and we don't fight them and we don't run from them, but we do a very subtle turning towards whatever is arising in this moment. And if we fight or turn away or fall in love with the things that are causing us suffering, then we also gently make that turn towards that. All of these things are manifestations of the Buddha Dharma, with no exception. What do we do about the end of civilization as we know it? Say quickly, say quickly. I'm not going to say. That's another koan. I won't say. This is for each one of us to determine. We take vows as students of the way to save all beings. That's a koan, by the way, because how could I prevent global warming? How could I prevent war? How could I prevent torture and injustice? There's no easy answer to this question, so I'm not even going to try. But for me, the practice of Zen turns me to something else, because Joanna Macy also trusted that turning towards pain allowed something else to arise, because she knew, and so many of us know, that the avoidance of pain and the fighting of pain and the falling in love with pain keeps pain stuck. It keeps it alive. It perpetuates suffering. But to make that subtle turn towards the pain, towards what she called despair, allows the rest of reality to arise together with the pain. I remember early in my Zen training hearing Thich Nhat Hanh get challenged in a Dharma dialogue, much like our Dharma dialogues. Somebody said to him, "You've been through so much suffering. You've survived the Vietnam War, and you've been a refugee, and you've seen your friends and loved ones be killed." And they said to him in a very challenging, angry voice, "Why do you keep smiling?" And Thich Nhat Hanh said in his lovely French-Vietnamese voice, which Josh thinks when I say it sounds like I'm speaking Russian, "I smile to my suffering because I know that I am more than my suffering. I smile to my suffering because I know that I am more than my suffering." And this is what happened in the Joanna Macy workshop. The second part of the day, after we delved into the despair of being born into a suffering world, despair all by itself, without us doing anything but turning towards it, transformed into empowerment. Because despair and empowerment, it turns out, aren't that different. There's a great energy that's being avoided in despair. Those poor Eli despairing in their beautiful paradise, waiting for the Morlocks to come and harvest them, had given up on life. Given up on the vividness of being alive to everything. So I'd like to end my talk today by reading you a poem. I first found this poem at a time when I was teaching mindfulness-based stress reduction for a living. I did this for 20 years at the University of Massachusetts. It was a nice way to learn to teach meditation, although a lot of the things I learned I've had to forget. But I was driving in one morning and I tuned in to the radio, because I love to listen to the radio on my commute. And Garrison Keillor was introducing Writer's Almanac. I always was happy that I hit it right on the dot when he would be on the radio. And he read this poem, and I was so touched by it that as soon as I got to work, I opened my computer, waited for it to boot up, which in those days took a little bit of time, and searched for the poem and found it and printed it off and read it to my class. It was the first class. It was the class where we introduce what meditation is. And I thought this poem said it all. And when I read it over this sesshin, I read it to someone in a doksan, and actually a second person in a doksan, I thought, this is it. This is what we're trying to do here. This is what all of the teachers and Dharma holders have been speaking to all week. This is what all of you in the Zendo have been dealing with all week. And the poem is by a local Massachusetts poet named Paul Hostofsky. And it's called Coconut. And here's the poem. Bear with me. I want to tell you something about happiness. It's hard to get at, but the thing is, I wasn't looking. I was looking somewhere else. Bear with me. I want to tell you something about happiness. It's hard to get at, but the thing is, I wasn't looking. I was looking somewhere else when my son found it in the fruit section and came running, holding it out in his small hands, asking me what it was and could we keep it? It only cost 99 cents. Hairy and brown, hard as a rock, and something swishing around inside. And what on earth and where on earth? And this was happiness. This little ball of interest beating inside his chest. This interestedness beaming out from his face, pleading happiness. And because I wasn't happy, I said to put it back. Because I didn't want it. Because we didn't need it. And because he was happy, he started to cry. Right there in aisle 5. So, when we got it home, we put it in the middle of the kitchen table and sat on either side of it and began to consider how to get inside of it. So this is it. This is Zazen. How do we get inside of it? How do we keep alive to the burning world? How do we keep alive to death and destruction, as well as to joy and happiness? For me, Zazen is an incredible technology of keeping the little ball of interestedness alive. What is the heart? What is the mind? What is the practice? How do I do shikantaza? How do I do breath practice? How do I work with a koan? How do I work with the koan of daily life? What's with all this bowing? What's with all this pain in my knees and ankles? What is going on? Keeping you interested. Keeping me interested. And never ending. Never ending. Placing the coconut squarely on the table. And keeping the mind of wonder and interest alive, even when the mind of wonder and interest manifests itself as boredom, frustration, and despair. Dongshan was unwell. A monk asked, "Your reverence is unwell. Is there someone, after all, who is not sick?" And Dongshan said, "There is." The monk asked, "Does the unsick person nurse, your reverence?" Dongshan said, The old monk is properly nursing that one. The monk asked, how about when your reverence nurses him? Dongshan said, then the old monk does not see illness or the absence of illness. Thank you. This is our last Dharma dialogue of Sesshin, and you all know what to do. Come forward with your heart and your honesty, and right here.
And your coconut.
We thought about getting Jeannie to put coconuts on the snack table, but not open them. But Dominic had already done the shopping, so... Yes, Julie.
There was a story about this historical Buddha I read one time. You can correct me on that. It changed some of the way I feel about these the big issues, the burning world. Because I tend to have kind of a rosy, or actually it's more of a green idealized picture of the time of the Buddha, that it was agricultural, there's no climate change, no nuclear war, you know, these monks going around in the forest. Not very nice. And it's only in one book that I read the story about the kingdom that he was from, and a neighboring kingdom got into a mess. I think there was some woman princess promises a bride, and they sent somebody else instead, and the other kingdom got pissed, and so they sent their army to go in and slaughter and take over his hometown. And I think the story went that he went out and tried to talk to the army as they came, and it didn't work. And the army went in and slaughtered his hometown. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With the best weapons they had at the time.
Yeah, right? I mean, they still could effectively kill people even without nuclear weapons and tanks. Yeah. And it's funny that I seem to have only seen that in one of the books, but it brought it home to me that this is not about being somewhere else.
This practice cannot be about outcome. And the Buddha went to the war front and tried to stop. His saving all beings, his vow to save all beings, included even that. Even this
Yes, Christy.
Thank you very much, Melissa. I was very moved by an article in Shambhala Sun by Thich Nhat Hanh. And it inspired me to come here with our burning world. And what he said in the Vietnam War is that if he did not go to his sangha and community every day, meditating and walking, he would have been burned out and good for no one. And it's how he kept his service and his heart alive, having no idea what the outcome would be. And at that particular time when I read that, my whole world was burning up. I was in a job I knew wasn't good for me. I felt in Sartre's room with no exits. And I just thought, okay, I am going to commit to be here. So he is so inspiring, and so was your talk.
Matthew.
I just wanted to give a sibling to the first comment, which is that think on the third day of this session, I realized that I've been treating the sounds and some of the objects and things that we were doing as foreign to me, because I'm literally foreign. I was thinking about my how I practice in London, and here I'm entering into Worcester and your lives and your practice and those. And so I was at a kind of distance from the literal sensations, because I was sort of they were yours, and then I realised that they were mine.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. I think it's so easy to other. I think one of the themes that is sort of we've been weaving through is this distancing we do, that it's very hard to catch, because it just seems, well, of course, I'm a foreigner. This is not. And something about the intimacy of practice, and maybe expanding the capacity to see what is ours, to see not to distance, but to allow this whole universe to be us, to open our heart, and that shift from the complaining they're not doing it quite right, or why don't they do, you know, to joining in the moment. So we make our life ours by joining in the moment and what's happening. Thank you.
There's somebody back there. It's Willie.
I want to talk a little bit about intention and outcome. And so yesterday when we were doing dinner and the dishes were going around, there was a little white moth that landed on Jess's shoulder. And I didn't want it to end up in the soup or the salad. So I grabbed it and I stuck it in my cup, my teacup, and stuck it on my cushion. And feeling really good about myself. saving this moth. And then after dinner, I took it out on the front porch and released it. And I had to shake it out of the cup because it didn't want to go. And it sort of fluttered down. And I thought, oh no, it's going to flutter on the path and something's going to step on it. But no, it ended up on the side of the path. And I said, oh, that's good. It can get its wits together and take off from there. And then I saw a little fledgling robin there. Looked up at me like, thanks. And ate it.
There is life, and there is death, and there is life and death, and there is beyond life and death. And Dogen says, because this is so, we call it no arising and no perishing. So good job saving that moth.
Tony and then Alan.
I appreciate it, Melissa, how you talked about the imagination. Mm-hmm. in my own practice, I've noticed how that can be a great tool and an asset, and how it doesn't always upset me, although it does sometimes. I can get into very creative problems, actually, because of it. We were in Kinhin last night, or a few nights ago, and there was someone waiting to get into the line, and I was so sure that they were a mannequin. I was really freaked out. I just saw them out of the corner of my eye, and I was having a weird time, and I thought it was a mannequin. But that was disturbing. But anyway, it's not all bad. I was reminded of by your talk of a practice that I do every night and morning, where I just imagine all the people who really love and support me in the room with me, and they all hold my hand, and we just smile at each other, and it's really nice. And I'm alone in the room, but the effect is very real. Imagination can be pretty good.
Yeah. When sometimes imagination cues into things that are actually true, like we are approaching the end of our civilization, so we kind of skew the fantasy goes to the aliens are coming, but we kind of feel these things as true, and there's some truth in the fact that everyone you love and everyone who cares for you is in the room with you. Mm-hmm. There's some way on the plane of no birth, no death, and birth and death, and all that. But that's really, actually, literally true. Mm-hmm. But not true in when we're just stuck in the form world alone. So, wonderful.
And the people who care for you are not just the people who you can name who care for you, but really all beings throughout space and time. They are also literally in the room with you, holding your hand. And we hold them in our heart. We hold them in our zazen. In our zazen of utmost non-effort. And this is a important part of how we actually do save all beings. It's not all of it. But it's not nothing.
So, I don't know how thoroughly you want us to take this coconut.
How what?
How thoroughly you want us to take this coconut metaphor, but as you know, throw a palm at me and, you know, I'll get sort of stuck on it. And, you know, I've had a lot of experience with coconuts because my dad was in the Pacific during World War II and he came home with a fondness for coconuts. Oh. So we had a little coconut ritual, you know, every year or so. And I passed this on to my kids. And I know exactly how to get inside. But the thing is, you need a hammer. Right? And right, so yeah. This is what, right? So at this point, you know, at this point in this show, I know there's a coconut.
Yeah.
I don't need to be convinced of that. And I'm not going to leave it in the store or pass it, you know. But it's the hammer that, you know, there's nothing more frustrating than bringing a coconut home for your kids and realizing that you don't have a hammer.
Yeah.
So tell us about the hammer.
I think we just demonstrated. I waved to you and David picked up his stick.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of the, when I was talking about the technology of Zen, coming to Dokusan, you know, you can hide out in the Sangha, in the Zendo, right, forever. But coming to Dokusan, it's a little hard to hide out. You meet the hammer.
Yeah. Oh, Josh. Josh Bartok, the hammer.
I was gesturing to my right and my left. So, but yeah, if you want to go there. So you know, this is something. These tools are just one set of tools. I mean, there's lots and lots of other sets of tools, right, in the world. We decided to do this construction project, and you know, make this raft. This is the raft we're using right now, and it's kind of cool. And it's not the thing itself, you know. The raft is not the shore, but yeah, just you know, showing up like this. It reminds me of another metaphor. We're free associating poetically here, but there's a koan. Where somebody asks, you know, if I'm a chicken and egg, and if I peck, will you hammer? And there's some way, with a little tiny hammer.
A face hammer.
Face hammer. There's some way that the awakening is co-created, in a way that the door to awakening, it's not the awakening itself, it's already here, but this teacher-student relationship, this being willing to show up as yourself and put the masks down, so hard. Oh, it's so shaming and embarrassing and all that stuff. But you come forward, right? And the teacher can then come forward and something happens. I think that's the hammer and the coconut. Yeah. And it usually doesn't hurt. It's been my experience. But sometimes it can hurt temporarily.
Yeah. And I think that we should be careful about thinking we know what the hammer will look like.
Yes.
Because we could say, you've been operating the hammer at the beginning of every period. each footfall, each calling of the bird, each bow. I think the teaching of Zen is that the hammer is everywhere sounding. A ringing in the great vastness of the universe, and occasionally we see that the hammer is here.
Yeah, I like that. Thank you.
And you say, I know there's a coconut. And here's the thing, Alan, in all sincerity, in addition to that, there is no coconut.
Did you guys hear that in the back?
No.
Oh, Alan
well.
Says.
Oh well. Oh well. Too bad. I just feel sorry for you. There's no coconut. There's no coconut. There's no coconut.
It sounded better the first time.
I thought my version was better. Genius.
Yours was funnier.
And Bob, yeah.
So I wanted, it's been bubbling in me this, one of the things that I remember Joanna Macy saying is that one of the ways from despair into empowerment is to get that we didn't create this mess all by ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we can't fix it all by our lone selves. And that instead of getting really buried under the despair and then you can't do anything, she said what my teacher Melissa often says to me is find your passion.
Mm.
You know, find, you can't do all of it, but you can find your piece of it. Which I was sitting here thinking about. That in Zen we know about together action. When we walk in kin, we are one body. Sometimes I really get that, walking together. That we're doing it together. And we become, by the end of session, we really are one body. And that image kind of expanded into that, and that if each of us finds our passion, our coconut, you know, our work, the best we can do. That's part of what we're learning here.
Yeah.
And it, Jeannie, you remind me of one of the teachings from a Native American medicine woman I studied with, and she said in her tradition the community exists to serve the dreams of the individual. And I think this is the kind of empowerment, and I hope that part of what we do for each other is to encourage us to show up not as I think you should show up, but as your heart calls to you, because we so need that encouragement to do it, that community Christine was talking about. But the function is not to serve the community and figure out, well, that, but what is the arising in my heart, that passion, and following that.
Yeah. Beautiful. Thank you.
Back to the coconut. the image of this dad, you know, in the supermarket, this hassled dad with a messy mind and unhappy, and he couldn't see the happiness, and then it was in his little boy's tears that he woke up. That seeing those tears woke him up, and it reminds me of Guanyin hearing the cries of the world, and there's something about hearing the cries and hearing the tragedies all around, seeing the tragedies all around us that not only that wake us up not just to sorrow but also to joy.
Right. Yeah. So well said. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much. So we've got somebody else before you, Pierce, but I see.
And what you just said, you know, is what Dongchan says in Jeweled Mirror, grieved for them and offered them the Dharma.
Grieved for them and offered them the Dharma.
Blessed are the cheesemakers.
Indeed.
Blessed are the cheesemakers.
What? So, Paul, did you have your hand up? Okay, it's you.
I used to have this love of this idea for community, like what it was, this kind of utopian concept that was there, and it really was. I was quite in love with it. And the thing was, is that when I interacted with others, it never was what I wanted, never what I had expected, never what they were supposed to be. And I had trouble. I really did. And for years, I used to practice on my own, as far as my Zazen practice. And, you know, I would read Zen Mind, Beginner Mind, again and again. I had no idea how many times I read. And read and sit. And my practice was something like a workout practice. Just kind of strength training, and I would fall away from it. That's there. And then at some point, I came here and started sitting with, as far as Melissa and David, as far as initially. And I don't have an idea of community anymore, in the sense. But I do love the Sangha. I do love all of you the way you show up. In my practice, it's not a workout. I mean, I hurt. But it's no longer this aspect of, you know, working out or this or that. I'm just sitting with all of you. This is the community. This is my love for this. I so appreciate your thoughtfulness and pointing at this aspect of living, we're social animals. So how are we going to live? So I love something.
Thank you, Paul. And Pierce.
Yes, thank you, Melissa. You know, I'm still mired in duality. I still have, in regard to this con, I have something that's like a little metronome going in my head. It goes, well, unwell, well, unwell. And I'm thinking too about, you know, personal practice, retreat practice, and practice in the world. You know, Josh's talk made me think about how we're all unwell, or at least we regard ourselves as unwell. And kind of extrapolating from that, I thought to myself, there's something wrong with the world in which everybody thinks that they are unwell. And but actually, in the external world, we have these ideals of wellness and success to which everybody is held mercilessly. So how to bridge the gap? I really don't know. I have no insight to offer, except that I just heard birth and death in a different way. Or rather, when I heard it today, somebody mentioned it, I visualized the words on the page, and I realized that those little hyphens are there to communicate something. It's a little clue, and somehow that was comforting, that here is a little visual clue in the form of words, which I love so much, that indicates the direction and might give me a possibility of reconciling myself to one and the other, or bringing them together.
Right. Thank you. I love that you don't have a solution to this or an insight into this. That's the beginning of really finding how birth and death and well and unwell are not two different things. The when you said that you had a dualistic mind, I felt like saying, get in line. You know, everybody in this room has a dualistic mind. And the dualistic mind does hurt us, but it's very important so that we don't mistake a turnip for a car. Right? Try to drive the turnip home. It's good, good. Differentiation is very useful. And we've been pointing all week to what you're beginning to get a glimpse of through those little hyphens. That maybe not this and that. Maybe only. Thank you, everybody.